on Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. I'm thrilled to have Dr. Bill Walsh with me again tonight. As many times as I've interviewed him, I think his topic is such an important one and a deep one that every time I interview him, I learn more things. And I have to say, Bill, this is probably the fourth or fifth interview, and I've learned things just since last week that I'm finally understanding. Things are finally clicking. So thanks for taking the time to let me pick your brain all these times.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here with you again.
So before we get started, would you just tell people a little bit about you and where to find you in case they want to look you up while they're listening to your interview?
Well, my name is Bill Walsh, PhD. Basically, I'm a scientist who's been studying brain function for about 30 years. I've worked with about 30,000 patients, starting with people with severe behavior problems. I actually started working with people in a penitentiary and ex-convicts trying to understand whether they had chemical imbalances or nutrient imbalances that might have affected them. And I've seen more than 6,000 cases of autism, thousands of people with depression, bipolar, schizophrenia. And I got involved heavily in work, with clinical work, but in the last 7 years I focused on a program. We are training doctors in advanced nutrient therapies, and since the last time I talked to you, Eva, we've done another 175 doctors throughout the world.
Really? And, oh my God, that's wonderful. Anybody in Atlanta?
I think probably, yeah.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
We now have 75 USA doctors scattered throughout the area, and I do think we did have somebody from Atlanta.
That's the most wonderful thing. So where can people find you?
Well, they can find us on the Internet at walshinstitute.org. Our organization is the Walsh Research Institute, and we're a 501c3 public charity. And we're also heavily involved in research. I've got a program that's just begun on epigenetics of schizophrenia. We got a nice $158,000 grant from a foundation, and we're trying to prove to the world that schizophrenia is actually an epigenetic disorder, which would lead, I think, directly to improved therapies and, more importantly, I think, to prevention, effective ways to identify people who are vulnerable to schizophrenia, and then showing them how to avoid it.
Yeah, that'd be great. I remember Abram Hopper used to talk about that a lot with nicotinic acid. So that would be thrilling to help those people.
Yeah, so, and you know, we've it's only in the last 6-7 years that we've understand why Hopper's vitamin B3 therapies were so helpful. He never was able to identify the mechanism, but now it's really an epigenetic mechanism. We now know that vitamin B3, niacin, niacinamide, nicotinamide, that it acts as a deacetylase inhibitor. And what it does is it changes gene expression of a chemical that dominates dopamine activity. And so now we know.
Really?
Now we know why that treatment works so well. It's too bad that Abram is no longer with us, because he would be thrilled to see the verification of what he had done.
Well, I don't want to go too far down this hole because I want to talk about hyper and hypomethylation and histamines and stuff. But I do want to ask you about this. I can remember Abram telling me multitudes of time that nicotinic acid was safe and that it was the best statin. So I happen to have a triglyceride and a problem. And so about 3 or 4 months ago, I decided to, I had all my lipids balanced. I use Athrotec to check my lipids. And every 3 months I would do this, and I had everything balanced but triglycerides. So I go, you know what, I think I'm going to try nicotinic acid. So I started using nicotinic acid in therapeutic doses, and I started getting covered up with lipomas. So I don't know if there's a connection or not, but it only started like maybe a month into therapeutic dosages of nicotinic acid. So I'm wondering if there's some connection.
There absolutely is a connection. Nicotinic acid is good for people who have a statins problem. It's also good for people with certain kinds of schizophrenia. But it actually helps some people and can harm others. And it depends on a person's biochemical individuality. And I think that's what happened. You apparently are one of those people who might be somewhat intolerant to it.
So what should I use? Are people like me?
Well, it depends on your individual biochemistry. And I would say primarily more than anything, probably depends upon your methylation status. Some people are under-methylated. Some people are over-methylated. Based on the enormous amount of data and people I've evaluated more than 30,000 people and determined their methylation status over many, many years. And it appears to me that about 22% of all people in the United States are under-methylated, and about 8% are over-methylated. The people who do beautifully on nicotinamide are the over-methylated people. And people who have normal methylation also can thrive on it. But the 22% who are under-methylated individuals, by the way, these are people who might test with high blood histamine, they tend to be possibly intolerant to it.
Is the nicotinic acid is, and I may not have the right words, okay, these are my words, I'm not a doctor, and by the way, that brings me up, Dr. Walsh, though he is a doctor, he's a PhD, is not attempting to treat or diagnose anyone. This show and the information on this show is just that, for informational purposes only. I just want to get that clear so nobody comes after us. So is it a methyl sponge? Does it mop up methyl groups? Is that why did it make me like really go into hypomethylation?
No, what happens is that people who are under-methylated tend to have, by nature, they tend to be low in the neurotransmission of serotonin and dopamine. And what nicotinic acid, by the way, nicotinic acid, another name for that, of course, is niacin. We're talking about niacin. And niacin, we've just found out, has a epigenetic impact that causes dopamine levels to drop. And it also tends to lower serotonin levels. So if you happen to be a person who had low serotonin and dopamine activity, and by the way, that I have that naturally. I'm an under-methylated person. And I can't take nicotinic acid, or also known as niacin, because it would tend to put me in the wrong direction with respect to neurotransmitters. It would make my statins better, but would tend to make my brain function worse.
So what would somebody like me do for triglycerides?
Well, of course, there's always diet. I think I'd try to avoid using a drug. There are drugs that could affect your triglycerides. How high are they?
Well, let's say I eat probably the cleanest diet of any patient you'd probably cross. I eat only grass-fed meat, only free-range chicken, only organic, everything else, and no grains. So I don't know, and I only use coconut oil to cook with, and if I use olive oil, I only use it to, you know, not heating it. I don't cook over medium heat. I don't know what else to do, except I really don't know what else to do.
Are your triglycerides, do they chronically test extremely high?
Yes.
How high?
Well, recently, the thing that made me go on the nicotinic acid where they were at about 350.
That is very high, right. Now, not everybody with high triglycerides runs into cardiovascular trouble. You may very well be one of those people, but how is your heart function?
Well, I've had a heart attack 3 years ago, a big one. But my histamine was really high. I don't know if you remember, but I let someone talk me into buying their vitamins really expensive vitamins. And they told me that they were all the best quality. And it was folic acid. And I have double MTHFR mutation, so my histamine just went off the chart. I took very large dosages of that stuff, and I guess, I don't really know what happened, but it made me have a heart attack.
Well, some people need to avoid supplements of folic acid, again, if they're under-methylated. Have you ever had a blood histamine test?
Yes, and sometimes it runs a little bit low now that I take 5-MTHF and I take methyl B12. So now it's back normal, but when I was taking that folic acid instead of the active form and I was taking lots of it, it made the histamine go off the charts.
Hi.
Made me get all red face and red all over the body, and it was, now I know wish I'd known back then what I was doing.
Well, people who are intolerant to niacin are the same people who are intolerant to folic acid.
And really?
And for the same reason. And see, these things tend to help your methylation. The MTHFR SNP mutation that you know about tends to make you under-methylated. However, the major impact of that SNP happened before you were born, and it had everything to do with the methylation that occurs on your DNA, and on your chromatin proteins, and this tends to give you. It tended to make you probably a low serotonin activity person and a low dopamine activity person, and dopamine is a serotonin reuptake promoter. The very last thing that someone like you should take, even though it would help your methylation, overwhelmed by the negative gene regulation problem. That it's all new. This is all new information based on this advancing science of epigenetics.
So, if you're an under-methylator, that niacin and dopamine make you methylate more, or regardless of what you are, they make you methylate more.
It's not the methylation that's the issue. I think for you the real issue is neurotransmission and the activity at your serotonin and activity at your dopamine receptors. And this is a totally separate situation from methylation. So what you did was smart, and everything you took, the methyl B12, the methylfolate, I'm sure they improved your methylation status. However, they would tend to give you pretty nasty side effects.
Yeah, they did. They do.
Yep. And now it's all sort of clear and understandable.
So what should someone like me do? And I don't want to go too far because this is not about me. It's just interesting me since you're helping me understand.
If a person has any issues related to how well they feel, in other words, if they don't have a mood problem, if they're not prone to depression or anxiety or to behavior problems, if they're sailing through life and everything is kind of smooth and easy for them, then there's not an issue. But if you have somebody who has a tendency for these problems, and I think I have some of that, I just got lucky, and the great Carl Pfeiffer tested my chemistry once and told me I was under-methylated and told me what to do about it, so I've never had a problem thanks to the great Carl Pfeiffer.
Wow.
I think what you need to do is identify, or anyone really, if you have ever had a tendency for that, and that includes postpartum depression, anxiety disorder, then the fixing methylation can actually cause more harm than good.
That's very interesting, because I have both. I had the high histamine and the depression stuff.
Well, what that means is that there are other ways to improve improve your methylation without using folic acid or any form of folate. Methylfolate, folinic acid, or folic acid, they all do the same thing. They all tend to make depression worse in people who are high histamine people. So that's a very good thing to know. It's something there are other ways to improve your methylation. Now, ideally, the best way would be for most people to use to do exactly what you did, but it would tend to make you feel a lot worse in your particular case, and people who have a tendency or a history of depression.
So what are the other ways?
Well, partly depends on your homocysteine level. I don't want to get too technical for your audience, but in the methylation cycle, the people with the MTHFR SNP, it's especially troublesome if a person has high homocysteine, and that has to do with cardiovascular health. So I'm sure that doctors have tested your homocysteine, and if it's elevated, there are other things you can do. For example, the B12 you took is a good thing. Another very good thing would be trimethylglycine.
That's a good idea.
And then B6 and serine, S-E-R-I-N-E. Those are four different nutrients that can nicely tend to normalize your methylation. Since you're not able, in your case, in your special case, you're not able to use folates, which is too bad, but you're not able to do that because of their impact on your gene regulation. So these things can do the job. B6 itself can help, and that would also help you with cardiovascular issues because I'll bet you have a tendency for high homocysteine levels, and that's associated directly with tendency for heart attacks and mm-hmm. high blood pressure and all kinds of cardiovascular.
Yeah, I did. Okay, well, as much as I'd like to talk about me, I'm not going to do that to my audience. I would like for you to talk about hypo and hypermethylation so people will know what they're, which one they think they have, histamine, food intolerances, and all the things that high anxiety, low libido, no sleep, underachievement in school, and give people an idea so that they can realize what they have may not be some diagnosis that their typical allopathic physician has labeled them. Maybe myalgias. If you could just give us some ideas about that.
I'd be happy to. Now, if a person, as I said, about 22% of human beings are undermethylated, and they're born with this, and it runs in families. And the typical symptoms, there's about 30 symptoms. I wrote a book called Nutrient Power, and in that book I list about 30 of the classic symptoms and traits of undermethylation. But they're an interesting group. They tend to be obsessive-compulsive. They tend to be self-motivated during school years. They tend to have a family history of high accomplishment. 75% have seasonal allergies or problems with, problems with ragweed or pollens and that sort of thing. They have more headaches than most people. They have a higher-than-average libido. They're prone to chronic depression, especially low serotonin depression, and a history of perfectionism. They tend to be very, very good at what they care about. If they play sports, they tend to be very competitive. If they take SSRI medications, antidepressants, this group usually responds fairly well in terms of the depression being eased, but the side effects are often so serious they don't want to go that route. And those are some of the key aspects of undermethylation. And fortunately, there's a couple of blood tests that can do, that are pretty good markers for methylation. One of them, whole blood histamine. Whole blood histamine is elevated in people who are undermethylated.
Let me ask you a question here. For the regular test, if somebody goes, and I don't want to distract too much from what you're talking about, I just want kind of yes or no or whatever. If you go to the doctor and just say, can I get a histamine test, is that what they'll give you?
Well, you probably would be better off if you could find a doctor who understands histamine and methylation. Like I said, we've been training doctors throughout the USA. We did 95 docs in the last 14 months. We expect to do another 100 or so in the USA in the coming year. So there should be a doctor who understands histamine and its relationship to methylation and to depression and anxiety and moods near everybody, hopefully, in a near term. I don't think the average doctor could order this. They could order a whole blood histamine test. LabCorp, for example, is probably the biggest lab in the USA, and they do a very nice whole blood histamine test. But the problem is your doctor probably wouldn't be able to interpret it. And it probably wouldn't be too comfortable ordering a test, not having experience with interpreting it and evaluating what it means.
Yeah, my child's pediatrician. You won't believe what happened. I know I did genetics testing on my 15-year-old, and it came back and said that he will have a tendency to histamine problems and heart disease. I asked his pediatrician if he would test his histamine levels, and he said no, and he got ugly. He said, no, I won't do that. And even if I did, I wouldn't know what to do.
And he's being honest. He's being honest, and basically...
Yeah, but he was ugly, and I said, well, I know what to do if I just know if he has the problems. He fired us as a patient.
Oh, really? That's
yeah.
too bad.
Now, yeah.
Anyone can get these tests done without their doctor ordering it. There's a lab called Direct Healthcare Access near Chicago, and they have it set up so that anyone can call and get this test and other special tests run. And they work with doctors in the Chicago area who are available to talk to a person and tell them what it means.
That's wonderful.
You don't necessarily have to go through your own doctor if your doctor is, as you put it, ugly.
Yeah, he was not happy about that. Anyway,
it would be really good, however, if you were able to get this information and spend a couple of months normalizing your chemistry. And then when you became strikingly better, then maybe he'd get interested.
He just did not care. He said, I don't want to know about nutrition. I don't want to know. Anyway, go ahead and finish telling us about you were on undermethylation and the test that you
did. We talked about undermethylation, and then a small number, 8% of people are overmethylated. And even some people with the SNPs in that methylation cycle, even people with 677 homozygous, a few of them are overmethylated. See, the genetic test is not decisive with respect to determining your methylation status. And there's a lot of people, nutritionists and doctors who are, you know, alternative doctors who are now trying to use that test as a determination whether what their methyl status is. The problem is they're all focusing on undermethylation, and there are SNPs and mutations that tend toward overmethylation. And to me, it's like a tug of war. You've got the MTHFR and methionine synthase and other mutations that you can find out in a 23andMe genetic test that tend to make a person undermethylated, but there are other SNPs that tend to make a person overmethylated. And the question is, who's winning this tug of war? And what happens is that you've got this, we have this wonderful chemical machinery that can produce this chemical called SAMe, S-A-M-E, which is our methyl donor throughout the body. And that enables us to have all the methyl, or is supposed to have, give us all the methyl we need to do these 80 or 90 really important reactions in the body. Well, about half of all your methyl goes to a single reaction. And that's the creation of creatine. And if that reaction is impaired, if that's weakened, if you've got SNPs in those enzymes, then you could wind up with a glut of SAMe. In other words, you've got, you know, plenty of methyl being produced, but it's not being utilized. So I'm sorry that it's a little bit technical, but that's the thing.
So are you saying if the creatinine is high, then you have this problem?
If you have problems converting to creatine. And
how do you know?
Well, that's why people who have high histamine and are undermethylated, they tend to be more slender they might be very strong and healthy, but they don't have bigger muscles usually than overmethylated people. They often make like football linemen. They have
okay,
and they have more muscle because of that. But the overmethylation symptoms are very different. For example, they tend to be hyperactive. They tend to have a sleep disorder. They tend to have a low libido. They are especially prone to anxiety and panic tendencies. About 3 out of every 4 people we've tested evaluated who had an anxiety disorder or panic disorder or panic attacks even, most of them are overmethylated. And these are the people who get worse if they take an SSRI antidepressant. They already have more serotonin activity than they're supposed to. And these drugs, of course, make it even higher. And we're quite sure that that's the reason for the school shootings in the United States. We've studied the last 50 cases of school shootings, And what we find is that most of them, more than 40 of these 50 people, were doing okay in life until they developed anxiety and depression, and they started taking an SSRI antidepressant like Paxil or Zoloft or something like that, and they got dramatically worse, and then disaster happened. About 16 months ago, I was at the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting, and I gave a paper along with the eminent Dr. Robert DeVito, a well-known psychiatrist, and basically we were trying to explain to the psychiatrists of the world that they're doing depression all wrong. That basically they believe, or mainstream psychiatry believes, that depression is a single condition, basically, and almost always involves low serotonin activity, and that the treatment of choice is are one or more of these antidepressants. But I have this huge chemistry database for depression, and it's very clear that depression is really a name they give to at least five completely different conditions. One of them are these overmethylated people who actually get horribly worse on if they get an antidepressant. And we've seen hundreds and hundreds of them, and they try one, you know, they may have tried Paxil and Prozac and Cerazone and all of them, and they get worse on every one of them. And it's because they don't have that kind of brain function. They have a different condition. After that talk, quite a few of the psychiatrists came and saw me after my presentation at this meeting, and a number of them have gone through our training program. And really, the psychiatrists that we've worked with, and now we have about three dozen psychiatrists doing this, they're the most enthusiastic people we've got. And see, now they can take a person with depression and run a few inexpensive blood tests and maybe a urine test, and they can find out what kind of treatment a person needs. And they can identify these people who will be intolerant to SSRIs. They also learn that there are nutrient therapies that can get the job done in many cases.
And which test would those be?
Well, whole blood histamine is one good marker. There's another good marker if you have a doctor or a clinic that does their own blood work that has phlebotomy, and they can spin down a sample and maybe add a chemical to it before they send it to the lab. There's a test called a SAMI, S-A-H, ratio test. It's a methylation profile test that just came out about 7 or 8 years ago from Doctors Data in a lab in Illinois. And those are two good markers. But what the doctors have learned, the doctors that we've trained, and we now have doctors that we've trained in Australia and Norway and Ireland, and as well as USA. In fact, we've already got doctors in 16 countries that are doing this. They have to do a good medical history, and after they learn a lot about the patient with respect to their symptoms, their traits, and their medical history, they can pretty much predict what the lab results are going to be. So it's a combination of knowledge of the patient and the blood work, and then they can usually very accurately determine and diagnose the methylation status, and then act accordingly.
That's a lot of new information in a short time.
Well, it's not expensive. The battery of lab tests that we use for evaluating people runs between $300 and $400, and most of the patients that we worked with, we would want to see them again after maybe 3 or 4 months, repeat some of the lab tests, and fine tune the dosages to make them exactly balance these factors, and then we would see them maybe once a year for a 30-minute checkup. There's not a lot of doctoring involved in this. But there are
some
amazing people we worked with who, first, the easiest people for us to help are a couple of groups. For example, violent children. If someone is a violent young man or young woman who just has a wild temper and tends to harm people or destroy property or has runaway temper and anger, they're about the easiest people to help. Based on a published study we did, if we can get them to comply with a nutrient program, about 90% of the families say that the problem often goes away completely, or there's a great improvement. Another really easy group to help are people with ADHD. And that often has to do with metal metabolism and copper and zinc imbalances, because those are a couple of nutrient factors, a couple of trace metals that have a major effect on brain function. And then there's postpartum depression. They're probably my favorite patients. And the reason is almost all of them report that the condition goes away. And for them, they have a type of, or I might say, chemical classification of depression that really is involved only with extraordinarily high copper levels. Because when a woman goes through the 9 months of a pregnancy, their copper level more than doubles because the little growing fetus needs that. And after the baby is born, within 24 hours, the copper level is supposed to go back to normal. But some people don't have that capability. Some people don't have the genetically expressed proteins that enable normalization of copper. So that's why right after they have a baby, or maybe especially if they have two or three children, they're the ones who have this mysterious, horrible depression that afflicts them. And we've met many women who suffered from postpartum depression that lingered.
I think I did. I know I did.
20 and 30 years. And almost all of them become okay once you simply get the copper out. And there are nutrient therapies that can accomplish that, usually within 2 or 3 months.
Wow. So let me ask you this. Do people, are they always either under or over methylators?
No. 70%, a little bit more than two-thirds of all people have normal methylation. They might have heart problems or cancer or, you know, other issues, but they don't have a methylation issue. They might have a metal metabolism problem. They might have a problem with toxic metals. They might have a problem with fatty acids. They might have physical issues, but not methylation. And they're fortunate. They're born with solid methylation. So it's the 22% of those who are undermethylated. However, for people with mental problems, for people with anxiety or depression or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, more than 70% of those people have a methylation imbalance. So it's really high in people with mental issues.
So one of the hottest things out there today is, because it's just come out and the public is just learning MTHFR. That's all they talk about. It's not all MTHFR, is it?
MTHFR is an enzyme that is genetically expressed, and it is the limiting factor factors. There's about 15 different important factors in the methylation cycle. That's the complicated chemical cycle that produces the methyl that we need. And there's been an overfocus on it. There's just so many people who believe that if you have a mutation, see, basically, if you have a mutation, that means that your MTHFR enzyme is weakened. Doesn't mean that it doesn't work. It means that it's somewhat weakened. And a lot of people with the MTHFR problem get through life just absolutely beautifully. So it doesn't necessarily mean you have to take action. If a person has the MTHFR problem and also high homocysteine, then I think you should definitely do something, because that could really affect your cardiovascular health. Another thing is there's a lot of nutritionists, if they see the MTHFR issue, they want to give people methylfolate and methyl B12, and that can harm some people. I would say probably two-thirds of the people who do that do quite well, but then there's a rather large number who get worse. And so now this is something that was sort of I don't want to call it a fad, but certainly something that got really popular in the last 3 or 4 years. And now all these, there's so many of these nutritionally oriented doctors who are wonderful, who now keep saying, well, why is it when I give this, why do some people get horribly worse? And now we understand why, and it's because fixing methylation may not be a person's major issue, especially if they have a depression, anxiety, a behavior disorder, or something like that.
So what about severe anxiety? I have so many people writing me who've been on this path of trying to fix their methylation, and they end up with terrible anxiety. How do they know how to fix? How can they fix that?
If a person happens to be over-methylated, and they might even have the MTHFR SNPs or other SNPs, they will become more anxious if they take.
Let's say they do have MTHFR. That's what most of the people say to me. I have two MTHFR SNPs, and I'm getting terrible anxiety. So let's assume that they do have that.
Hey, there's about three biochemical causes of high anxiety. Undermethylated people are prone to high internal anxiety. These are people who might look very calm, but they are just torn up with internal anxiety. Then there are people who are overmethylated, and usually the difference there is everybody knows that they're anxious. You can tell that they're on edge all the time. And they have high anxiety for a different reason. The first group, the undermethylated people who have the internalized anxiety, which can be really quite awful, they tend to be obsessive-compulsive. They tend to be high-accomplishment people, people who might even be at the top of a profession, but they have this really high anxiety. So I think it's important to first find out the reason for the anxiety. It could be a methylation issue, either over-methylation or under-methylation.
So if you're under-methylated and you're taking supplements to make yourself better and you do too many, can that take you into over-methylation?
No, I don't think so. I think the key really is to get the right methylation therapy.
Okay.
If a person is under-methylated, most under-methylated people with anxiety must avoid folic acid of any kind, folinic, folate, or methylfolate. It will tend to make them worse. It'll tend to make their serotonin activity lower, and that's why they get worse. Even though their methylation may improve, their patient will get worse. And we've seen this literally thousands of times. I've worked with 30,000 patients with mental issues, and it was really it was a big mystery really until the last 7 or 8 years when we finally understood the mechanism of why. And the reason is folates are serotonin reuptake promoters. And people with low undermethylation and low serotonin activity, what makes them better are serotonin reuptake inhibitors, just the opposite. And fortunately, it's not only these drugs that are serotonin reuptake inhibitors, but we have nutrients that can do the job, like methionine and SAMe are serotonin reuptake inhibitors and can do the same thing that the drugs can do.
What if you have homocysteine issues? Is it safe to take methionine?
No. If we get a person who has, let's say they're undermethylated, and we can't give them folic acid, and we want to elevate their serotonin activity to go after the depression. What we do is if they happen to have high homocysteine, if they're over, say, 10 or 15, we have to fix the homocysteine first. But it only takes about a month. If you get that person and give them a fair amount of serine, trimethylglycine, and especially B6, B6 tends to reduce homocysteine really nicely. Just B6 alone with serine, S-E-R-I-N-E, and the standard dose is about 500 milligrams, usually within about a month, then the homocysteine is normalized, and now it's safe to give them methionine or SAMe.
Oh, okay. You take the B6, do you have to do P5P, or can you just do regular B6?
P5P is more potent, and it's really the P5P itself that directly reacts with the homocysteine to help down.
Okay, so what about the other people that have external anxiety?
Usually come in either of two groups. They tend to either have over-methylation or they tend to have a pyral disorder. Pyral disorder people also have really extreme anxiety. However, they are the people who have a set of symptoms that is really classic, and usually you can detect this within 15 minutes of getting information from the patient. They tend to be morning people. I mean, they're not morning people. They hate mornings. They tend to stay up late at night. There are people who tend to skip breakfast. They are non-competitive. They, as a group in general, they tend to make wonderful neighbors. They're not competitive. They care about other people. Have great empathy for others. They usually have little or no dream recall. They tend not to recall their dreams. They tend to underachieve in school, no matter how smart they are, because they have very poor short-term memory. There are some brilliant people with pyrrholes who never did well in school, because they would say if they read something, if they read a few pages, they might understand it perfectly, but then forget what they read and have to go back and check it over. And it's hard to achieve in school if you have poor short-term memory. They tend to like spicy foods. They have a double deficiency of zinc and B6, and it's generally an inborn hereditary disorder that runs in families, and you can usually follow that right up a family tree, and see. And they're prone to very poor stress control. They're usually famous for their temper, although there's exceptions. But many of them have white streaks in the pink of their fingernails. That's a symptom of zinc deficiency. But very, very high anxiety. They tend in general to have a negative attitude. They live in a world of fear. So this is another completely different condition that can cause anxiety. And probably one more is these copper overload people, like the postpartum depression people, females. High copper levels itself tend to cause high anxiety and sleep problems. And the reason is that copper is directly involved with two neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine. And if you're a high copper person, you will tend to have much lower dopamine and much higher norepinephrine levels. And that's a recipe for underachievement. It's a recipe for high anxiety. So there's more than one cause of anxiety. So if a person has serious anxiety, you really need to find out what the cause is, because each one of these requires a different treatment approach.
And if someone finds one of the people that you've trained, they can help them determine with any of these issues?
That's what I would recommend. Again, on the book I wrote, Nutrient Power, or on our website, if you check the resources section, especially our website, we keep adding all these new doctors who are now regularly doing this kind of treatment. Hopefully you can find one in your area and find somebody who knows how to do this. But the lab testing, I think, would cost something like $300.
And
they would be expert at evaluating it and finding out the type of depression or the type of anxiety or the type of bipolar disorder, and even in some cases the type of schizophrenia, and give a targeted therapy that is very likely to help them.
Well, I'm pleased to say I looked up on your site and there is now a doctor in Atlanta. I'm so happy.
Well, good. I knew we had somebody in Atlanta, and we don't put their name on our website until we check and make sure that they're actually doing this kind of work and that they're getting good results.
So we have about 15 minutes. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I myself am partly a researcher, and I love experimental research, and I think that there are new therapies that are coming that are going to actually improve our capability dramatically. I think the greatest improvements are going to be in the area of prevention. For example, I think that it won't be too many years from now when we'll be able to take a newborn baby and do fairly inexpensive battery of laboratory tests, blood, urine, and perhaps some genetic testing that might cost a couple hundred dollars. I think we'll be able to identify the people, for example, who are prone to autism. And if we can identify the 1 or 2% of children who are prone or vulnerable to autism, we could tell a family how they can avoid it without having to use drugs. I really believe that autism is eventually, and not too far from now, is going to fade away from society, just like polio did.
One of my listeners emailed and said, do you believe that the Dukes 15 or Trisomy 15 kind of autism can be helped using nutrition?
Well, that's a different thing. The trisomies, including the Downs kids, that they have, they often are misdiagnosed as being in the autism spectrum, and I don't believe that it's a separate condition that hasn't had a lot of study. You know, I wish I knew the answer to that. My guess is they could be helped by nutrition, but I have no evidence of that because we haven't done enough of them. But it's a different issue. Most classic autism is epigenetic in origin. These are people, almost all autistics are undermethylated. Almost all of them. 95 to 98% of accurately diagnosed autistics are undermethylated. And what happens is that they are born with a vulnerability. Almost all of them have a problem with coping with oxidative stress. We're all supposed to be born with glutathione and metallothionein and catalase. We have an army of wonderful chemicals in our body to cope with these outside influences like toxic metals and whatever, and protecting us against oxidative stress. Well, autistic kids, and I've tested 6,500 of them. I think I've seen as many autistics as anybody, and I've got a huge chemical database. They are all extraordinarily overloaded with free radicals, and I think that's the reason why they're so prone to autism. So if we could say that within a few months after they're born, run a couple of tests, identify which ones have this weakness, I really think that we could effectively prevent autism from occurring.
Wow, that would be great.
I think that's the easiest thing to do. Once autism strikes, and in most cases, 81% of autistics are regressive, which means that they start off life quite normally without any significant problems. And usually between the ages of 16 and 22 months, autism can strike really suddenly. I've talked to hundreds of families who said it happened within just a couple days. And this beautiful, happy child who might be starting to talk and singing and charming their grandparents, very often within 2 or 3 or 4 days, they will change dramatically, and this terrible condition can, you get the onset of the terrible condition, and then it doesn't go away. The problem with autism is that I'm convinced it's epigenetic in nature, and what that means is that the environmental insults have overwhelmed their DNA and altered their DNA function forever. And so it's extraordinarily difficult to make real progress with autism. You can make great progress if you get them early. There's a window of time. If you get them before they're 3 or 4 or 5 years old, there's a really good chance of getting them so they can come back and function quite normally. There's been quite a few recoveries of autism, but almost always you have to start early intervention.
So let me ask you this, and we've got 10 minutes. Many spectrum disorders, is there gradients in the autism, like autism to one degree, and then all the way on the flip side would be ADHD, perhaps? I mean, is there a gradient there, or are they separate things? Does that make any sense? It's hard to find the words.
I think it makes no sense whatever. And let me tell you why, Eva.
Okay.
Back when people started studying autism, autism has about 14 classic symptoms. And most autistics have some level of all of these. Poor immune function. They tend to have odd repetitive movements. They tend to have a divergent gaze. They tend to have extreme GI tract problems. They have weak immune function. They tend to have their copper and zinc, disrupted. I think that's a completely unique condition. And what I found was that there were a lot of companies making a lot of money from autism families, and these are people who did the lab work, the expensive lab tests, and then, of course, the people who had the treatments, especially nutritional or hyperbaric systems, et cetera, and they wanted to expand their market. So what's happened, and I really am unhappy about this, there now is a tendency to call autism things an autism spectrum disorder, which I don't think have anything to do with autism. For example, if you've got a child who might be fairly bright and has very poor socialization, they're likely to be called, if they have two or three of the autism symptoms, they're likely to be called in the autism spectrum, but they really aren't.
Well, what is it then if a child's like that?
Oh, they might be kids that have been around forever. They might, some kids are late bloomers and might have symptoms that seem troubling early, and then they amaze everybody in their teenage years or later by being late bloomers and do quite well. A lot of these kids would be fine if you just left them alone or gave them or balanced their nutritional levels. Now, one example is Asperger's disorder. Now, that one's real, and that's in the autism spectrum, and that one belongs in the autism spectrum. They used to put Rett syndrome. Back in 1994, the psychiatry world decided that Rett's was a form of autism. But it really
is. So what is Asperger's exactly, so people know? And we don't. Let me see how much time we have.
Well, if you've seen the movie Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman, that is a classic case of Asperger's. He didn't have classic autism. He had classic Asperger's, and if you recall, he had difficulty, great difficulty with communication and socialization. He was obsessive compulsive, and had rituals. He always had to watch the same TV program, et cetera, and they tend to be brilliant, but it's really a very serious, debilitating disease. And I've seen hundreds and hundreds of true Asperger's cases. But now I'm seeing more and more misdiagnosis of people are saying they're on the spectrum. And really, they're doing treatments, I think, that are inappropriate for most of these people, most of these kids.
So could it be like metal toxicity is doing it?
That's
sugar?
A possibility. There's a number of possibilities. Another issue is depression. There was, when they were trying to develop the new diagnostic manual, you know, DSM-5, there was a fight between the psychiatrists whether they wanted to have depression as a spectrum disorder with different component parts, or whether it should be a single condition and call it a spectrum, which means variation along a central theme. In this case, depression, the central theme would be low serotonin activity. Unfortunately, the people fighting for the spectrum succeeded, and now and we still continue to have the misinformation from that. There was a fight between people called the clumpers and the splitters with depression and schizophrenia, and the scientific people, the more of the researchers and the PhDs, they were the splitters. They wanted to consider these different types of depression as different disorders. Unfortunately, they lost. I think basically there's a tendency to say somebody's on the spectrum, and they really aren't. And it's really an excuse to use a therapy, maybe an autism kind of therapy, and for example, that really is not appropriate.
That's certainly food for thought. Thank you. I mean, it certainly gives people. I talk to so many parents because I have kids. I still have smaller kids, you know, a little teenager anyway. And I talk to so many parents, and that's all I ever hear about from these parents. So it certainly gives them a new way to look at what's going on. So we have about 3 minutes. Is there anything else? Is there anything new you want to briefly touch on?
There really is. And what's really new is that because of epigenetic science, we now are better able to understand how nutrients can affect enzymes and can more directly affect neurotransmission. And we're going to learn a lot more. The science is still evolving, but we already know enough how to help, that they can just help us to effectively use nutrient therapy in ways we couldn't just 5 years ago. And that's just going to continue and continue. Another thing I wanted to mention was ADHD. ADHD now is another extraordinarily overdiagnosed condition. The Center for Disease Control has measured it rather carefully, and it's around 8.4% of all children have this thing called ADHD, which has different forms. it can be behavioral for some, but in most cases it has to do with inattention and maybe a person who might be what you would call a space cadet. But there are entire large cities where 40% of all the children are given stimulant medications. I mean, obviously, it's overdiagnosed. Kids are being over-drugged.
What do you think it is?
Well, I think there's a tendency to go in that direction. Part of the problem might be some of the teachers who don't want to. I have difficulty with kids who they might have difficulty in their classroom, and they'd like to have them take a medication that'll make the classroom easier to deal with. Or maybe there's a parent who wants their children to be exceptional, and they too quickly go to medication to try to help them.
If they truly have it, though, what do you think it? Because we only got like a minute and a half. What do you think it would be?
Well, I think
methylation.
I think stimulant medications do help quite a few of these kids do better in school, but the long-term studies are very disturbing. They've studied thousands of kids who were diagnosed with ADHD and got the medications like Ritalin or Adderall, and then they've studied thousands who had the same kind of symptoms but never got the medications, and they find that the medicated kids do somewhat better in school, but then when they're 30, 40, 45 years old, there's a higher incidence of drug abuse, of criminality, divorce, depression. The long-term studies are not good. So I think that those things are more of a last resort and not the first.
So where do people look, though? I mean, if they've done drugs and they don't know what else can they do?
Well, I think what they can do is go to a doctor who understands metal metabolism and methylation, and because very often that's what the problem is. And you often can fix the problem without having to resort to a drug.
Okay. That's fabulous. I'd love to be able to tell people something, because people don't know where to turn.
And well, I'm prejudiced. I'd like to recommend the book Nutrient Power, or to go to our website. I think they can get a lot of information from the WalshInstitute.org website, and I think that people should just learn as much as they can and realize you don't always need a drug to solve a problem.
And if you type in William Walsh on Google it, you can find multiple videos and interviews where other people have interviewed Dr. Walsh, because I do it. There's multiple. So feast yourself upon that, because there's plenty out there if you just take a few minutes to look.
Yes,
Thank you.
Our children are our greatest resource, and I think we have to do the very best to give them the best life they can have.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Walsh, for taking time to come on. As usual, I'm so grateful to have you.
Well, Eva, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Have a good evening. Good night.